From the land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report. It is the 17th day of April, 2023. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Out of the office today, traveling to Washington, D.C. with the National Association of Farm Broadcasting. We'll hear more from there later in the week. However, today, we'll talk with Ben Brown of Missouri University Extension about the agricultural commodity markets and Carl Zuloff of the Ohio State University. He's an agriculturalist. Economist emeritus there will discuss the farm bill and set the table for some of the discussion. We'll hear the rest of this week from the Washington Watch event that NAFB is sponsoring in D.C. And we'll do all of that right here on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online, listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org or search us out in your favorite podcast application. Look for Commodity Week or the Closing Market Report.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
As you know, I'm traveling this week in Washington, D.C. for the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention's Washington Watch event. I spoke on Friday with Ben Brown, agricultural economist for Missouri University Extension. He's with FAPRI, the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute. Here's a portion of that particular interview. Hi, Ben. Thanks for being with us. Let's talk about something farmers really ought to be thinking about as they put the corn and soybean crop for 2023-24 in the ground. I think the risk to the downside is on their minds. I'm wondering how you see price moving forward, the inverses in the market at this point as well.
Well, price should be on producers' minds. There's the opportunity here to produce a very large crop here in the United States following a very large crop in South America. And when those conditions arrive, then it's a matter of, can we use enough of it to kind of moderate prices? And I think we're still struggling a little bit with use just from a couple of different components. But certainly, I think as we head through the spring, right now the market and really analysts in general, and I'm not picking on anybody in particular, I'm even throwing myself in that category. You know, we're trying to find every storyline we can to make a case that prices, or we're in this, you know, environment where prices are going to shoot higher. Okay, so you know, a couple weeks ago, well, not even a couple weeks ago, earlier this, you know, just this month, and we're only halfway through, but earlier this month, you know, the story was all about, can the upper plains get planted? Are we going to see challenges planting here in the Corn Belt? And certainly, like, that could happen. I'm not downplaying the scenario in the upper plains in terms of their ability to get adequate field conditions to plant. But we've got a long ways to go still. And I think we've built in a lot of that premium already because we're looking through the lens of trying to figure out how to get these markets to go higher. Another example would be, you know, the storyline out of Ukraine now that Russia is adamant that they only signed a 60-day agreement and that they want that agreement to be renegotiated here in May with concessions from the West. You know, again, that's a thing that we've built some risk premium into our feed grain markets, corn and wheat. And, so if we're sitting here, my reason for telling you this, Todd, and my caution, I think, to analysts and market observers like myself, so I'm throwing myself in this camp, is we've built in almost the worst case scenario across the board. And so even if those conditions were to come true, that's already built in, and the market's not going to go a whole lot higher. It'll go higher a little bit, but you know the real risk is to the downside here. Is if some of those, you know, if some of those issues don't come true, there's a lot of downside risk in these markets. So that would be my case. Is we built in the risk premium already.
Have you done the supply and demand tables using the Ag Forum numbers and? What do they look like if that's what USDA NAS puts into those figures for the May World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate? And I should correct myself, that's the World Agricultural Outlook Board that would be using those numbers.
Correct. So They'll keep the trend line yield that USDA released in February. So those trend line yields will stay the same, but then they'll incorporate that farmer's perspective planting survey or the planting intention survey that came out at the end of March. And you know, it's showing increasing stocks, not only increasing stocks, but potentially, you know, we could see even larger carryover from this old crop, right? I think we got a little bit of demand, you know, changes or reductions that'll increase ending stocks. That'll roll over to the next year. So increased beginning stocks, increased production, slightly increasing demand from where we were this year. But not enough to keep ending stocks for next year growing. Like, that's the story across corn, soybeans, and wheat as we look ahead to next year. Now, of those three, wheat probably has the tightest story to tell, just given, and it kind of depends on classes, but certainly that winter wheat and that hard red winter wheat category is going to remain tight, at least in our expectations as we look ahead. But growing stocks for corn and soybeans, stronger demand recovery in soybeans than corn. And so, you know, that kind of helps keep soybean prices a little bit stable, but, you know, growing supplies. Now, let me go back, or let me back up here just a second, go back to what I was talking about. We've already built some of that risk premium in. Just 2 weeks ago, we got our updated grain stocks report. So these would have been grain stocks on hand, whether on farm or in commercial, as of March 1, and the trade missed it. I mean, they're not by a lot, but they missed it, right? And the expectation was is that USDA would then build those grain stocks into their USDA report. However, they didn't make any changes to corn and soybean that would signal, you know, that they felt that those grain stocks or that they were incorporating those grain stocks. So what that tells me, right, and I did my shorthand version as well, and I certainly came out very close to, I think, where USDA was ahead of this. But by USDA not making any changes, that signals that they had already baked that shock in, and the market was the one that was surprised, right? And so we had built in some risk, and that caused, you know, that caused that change. And you know, that's my overarching point here, is there's a lot of already built in expectation of shortfall, but we haven't really addressed this mammoth crop that could potentially coming. And as a result, old crop corn basis staying strong through the summer, but a very strong divergence in that basis market by the time that new crop comes. And so we can talk about the carry in the market, and it's certainly there, suggesting that the market needs grain now and that there'll be more in the future, right? Like, but the basis market is where producers could actually see the biggest change in their cash price. You know, some places are positive 30 cents, but then you look to new crop and it's negative 50, right? That's an 80 cent change just in your cash price of your product. And so keep that in mind as we're thinking about, you know, some of these forward contracts and looking ahead, is that the basis market is already signaling a complete inversion. So making that aware for producers that basis is going to be a big whiplash this year.
Hey, thank you much. I appreciate it, Ben.
Thanks, Todd.
Ben Brown is with University of Missouri Extension and the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute, otherwise known as FAPRI. Stay with us here on Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world, online at willag.org. Up next, we'll talk with Emeritus Agricultural Economist from The Ohio State University, Carl Zulov, about the 2023 Farm Bill. You, Nick Paulson, and Gary Schnitke went through some numbers thinking about the 2023 Farm Bill and farm program payments that have been made over the last couple of decades, frankly, and have come to a conclusion, and we'll get to this in a bit, that there may be a need for a third pillar in the U.S. farm safety net. Can you go through maybe some of the data and the methods and some of those sorts of things to begin with to set the stage for me?
The data that we're using comes from what's called the Farm Income and Wealth data set maintained by USDA Economic Research Service. It's as comprehensive a data set on the income flows to farmers, the expense flows that they pay for inputs, as well as their wealth. It's considered sort of the premier data set for an encompassing look at agriculture in total. And of course, they break it out by different segments, by different inputs, et cetera. One set of that data has to do with government payments that farmers have received from a variety of programs. Basically, anything that's a cash flow income to the farm itself. That would include commodity programs. That includes the net indemnity payments. And what I mean by that is that's the indemnities that farmers have received minus the premiums that they have paid. They actually record both of those so you can calculate the net indemnities. And then it includes this other category, which for lack of a better term, is we call the non-commodity program non-insurance payments. The data set for this third category goes back to 1998 and has been carried forward since then. It would include the pandemic assessment the assistance that was received for both USDA and non-USDA assistance, and that would include the PPP program, the Payroll Protection Program. It would include the CFAP program. It includes the Market Facilitation Program for the trade wars, the tariff wars in 2018, 2019. But it actually goes all the way back to 1998 and starts in 1998 because, at least I think because, that was the first really large ad hoc program that we had had. There was a financial crisis around the world that significantly reduced commodity prices, farm prices in particular, and Congress created a couple of programs to assist farmers. If we look at this thing, and probably the easiest way to look at this is to think about it over time from 1998 to 2022, which is the period for which national data is available. There were a total amount of these other programs, non-commodity programs, non-insurance payments to farmers. They totaled $143 billion over that 25-year period. If you remove 2020 and 2022, those payments for those 3 years, it's still $77 billion. So these have been large payments that have accumulated over time. As a point of reference, the commodity program payments over the 1998-2022 period, as recorded in the income and wealth data, totaled $192 billion. And the net crop insurance premiums, and these actually come from USDA, RMA, totaled $89 billion. So these are substantive payments, and they compare, and whether you're looking at them as just payments themselves or looking at them in the context of the other farm safety net payments.
It's interesting when you think about those numbers, and I will divide these, quote, three types of payments, what you eventually will call three pillars, into things farmers are familiar with. The crop insurance paid out the least amount at $89 billion over that 25-year time frame. It's also the program that producers like the most. The commodity programs, which are ARC and PLC today, but have gone under several different names over that time frame, at $192 billion, actually the largest payment of the three, and then that $143 billion when what I'll call the ad hoc payments, sometimes the disaster payments. They're all really big sums, and I suppose they've all been really important for the farmer's bottom line, for the health of the agricultural industry in the United States over that quarter of a century.
I would agree with that. Your question raised something that I'd have to look at to say, but I would guess that at least one of those years from 1998 to 2022, each of those programs made the largest payment in that particular year. And so it's, you know, the fact that they're that large over that period of time suggests to me that this really is another part of the farm safety net that oftentimes is not included. If you want to call it the ad hoc set, the disaster assistance set, it's really all of those. It's really the other programs that are related to the production of agriculture for which the government provides support, sometimes on an ad hoc basis, sometimes on a disaster basis. It depends on what the event is.
So I think maybe we should go back through that very quickly, because what you've just told me is that in certain years, I would say, for instance, 2012, crop insurance probably paid out more than anything else. But other programs may not have been there if crop insurance wasn't there in that case, when farmers really might have needed some help. And there are other instances in other years. And you're suggesting that these three programs work together, have worked together over that 25-year span to make sure that farm income is more level across time. Is that a good way to think about it?
I think that's one way to think about it. And yes, I think that I really think that as you look at the numbers and reflect upon them, and the programs do seem to be working together. They seem to respond to, well, I'll put it this way, Todd. You have the standing commodity programs, which are in Title I of the Farm Bill. They are considered to be countercyclical programs now, largely, to sector-wide declines in revenue or price. We do both price programs and revenue programs. You have the crop insurance program, which, if you look at the numbers, is largely a payment for yield losses. Whether they happen in a high income year or a low income year, it's a payment for the yield loss. So they're targeting yield losses. And then you have the other category, the non-commodity program, the non-insurance programs that oftentimes are ad hoc specific events, such as hurricane damage. For would be one, fire damage in recent years, or have been where a gap has developed in the other programs. And I think of that, particularly that was true in 1998, 99, 2000, 2001. We spent over $20 billion to shore up assistance to farmers because prices suddenly plunged and no one had expected that to happen. You could argue the same thing happened in 2018 with the market facilitation programs, where payments were disproportionately large to soybeans because the reference price for soybeans was so low. So that the third reason that you get this other category is a gap has suddenly been in the traditional support pillars, the crop insurance or the commodity programs that legislators think needs to be addressed by assistance. That's why I think you can think of them as actually working together to provide the safety net.
In this safety net discussion online at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu, you suggest that these non-commodity program insurance farm payments should be considered as a third pillar in the farm programs. The 2023 Farm Bill is under debate as we speak. What should Congress ask about these payments? How should they go about potentially bringing them into the farm program more completely?
Historically, what Congress has done when we have had a jump in or a spike upward in these other program payments is that they've tried to, and the words that's used is most commonly, is capture those payments by instituting either new commodity programs or crop insurance products, or by enhancing existing products. That's been the traditional response. That's what happened after the 1999 to 2001 big increase in ad hoc payments. They showed up in the 2002 Farm Bill as what was called the countercyclical program, which we now call the price loss program. So Congress created that program in response to the high market loss payments made in those years. They captured them in a sense by creating, enhancing a commodity program. So one of the possible routes that could happen in the 2023 Farm Bill is that we could see Congress attempt to capture the large ad hoc payments and other disaster payments of the 2022 period by in some way, shape, or form redesigning the commodity program or the crop insurance program, or by creating a new program to capture those and become what is called a standing program, one that's authorized by the Farm Bill. Another approach that could happen would be for them to in somehow routinize the disaster assistance or ad hoc procedure so that there would be like standby authority that could be given to the secretary. It could reside in Congress. There are a variety of different ways that you could do that. Probably many of which we haven't even really thought about, to be honest, Todd. In other words, the policy process would be creative in coming up with the design of those programs. But that would be the other principal approach that would be there to somehow make these programs have a more routinized process for emergence as a stress-inducing event occurs.
We appreciate you taking the time with us today, helping to explain some of this, creating some more questions as well along the way. For those who are interested, they can read more from Carl Zuloff on the Farm Doc Daily website. They're looking for an article that is entitled Farm Payments by Programs Other Than Commodity Programs and Crop Insurance, Third Pillar of the U.S. Farm Safety Net. Carl, along with Nick Paulson and Gary Schnitke, who are from the University of Illinois, have penned that article. Again, Carl, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Carl Zuloff is an emeritus agricultural economist from The Ohio State University. Joined us here on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online at willag.org, WILLAG.org.